It's Thursday, February 5, 2015. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On The Briefing, we don't get to discuss just those issues that are easy to discuss. When it comes to the most fundamental issues of the Christian worldview, fundamental biblical truths, especially a truth like the dignity and sanctity of every single human life, those issues, especially when they appear in the form of a new argument, demand our attention. As much as it may be difficult to talk about this essay, the essay that will be the focus of our concern, as much as it is horrifying to address head-on the arguments made in this essay. The article comes from the liberal website Think Progress. It's by Tara Culp Ressler. It's entitled, "The Next Anti-Abortion Strategy Lurking Around the Corner." Writing in the essay, the author says, in what could represent their next major effort to dismantle the protections under Roe v. Wade, abortion opponents are laying the groundwork for a new attack on reproductive rights that borrows a page out of their old playbook. This is a very important essay. It is a horrifying essay. Culp Ressler writes, quote, several pieces of similar legislation emerging on a state level could be the beginning of a national trend. The measures, she says, are cloaked in emotional language about fetal dismemberment that's reminiscent of the pro-life community's successful push to enact the country's first national abortion ban. What's she talking about? That's the partial birth abortion ban that was adopted by Congress, signed into law by President George W. Bush, and eventually upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States of America. And it came only after majorities in both houses of Congress came to the conclusion that what was represented in terms of the partial birth abortion was something so horrifying that it simply couldn't be legal. Because it's absolutely necessary, let me remind you that a partial birth abortion was one in which a nearly fully formed baby, indeed in many cases a fully formed baby, just hours indeed or minutes before it might otherwise be born, was born in every way except for its head in order that the abortion would take place then and that the baby would be killed. As Senator Moynihan said, and he was a liberal Democrat himself, we're not talking about something that's almost the intentional murder of a child. We're talking about the murder of a child. The argument made in this essay was that the partial birth abortion ban was itself an insidious assault upon a woman's reproductive choice. The actual implication of this article is that the baby, even up to the point where it is minutes before being born at full term, is not a person who deserves any kind of standing whatsoever. The author of this essay makes very clear that, at least in physical terms, she understands exactly what a partial birth abortion is. It is a process that allows the birth canal to expand in order, quote, to allow an entire fetus to pass through, end quote. She does acknowledge exactly what the process is. What she doesn't acknowledge is that the child is actually a human being, a human person. Looking back with lament to the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003, she then writes about what she describes as the current challenge of new legislation, and she quotes Dr. Ann Davis, identified as consulting medical director for Physicians for Reproductive Health and an OBGYN who does abortions. She told the website, quote, this is a familiar tactic, similar to the other types of bans we've seen. It seems the strategy is to take language that provokes emotional responses and then to argue that because there's an emotional reaction to something, it should be illegal, end quote. Now remember, what we're talking about here is what's being described as an emotional reaction to something, and that something is the murder of a child. Culp Ressler then writes, quote, this time around, the legislation is a little more detailed, providing what she describes as a graphic definition for dismemberment abortion. As important as this issue is, as crucial as it is that we discuss it, I simply can't describe the process as it's described in this article. But what we need to come to terms with is the fact that the DNE, or dilation and extraction form of abortion that's being addressed here, is a form of abortion that tears the unborn child apart in the womb before it is removed. And as hard as it is to hear or to speak about such things, just imagine this sentence from her essay, quote, this type of abortion, which takes about 30 minutes to perform, has become the standard practice for terminating a pregnancy after 12 weeks, end quote. Back when the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act was being discussed, we were told that it was a very rare procedure, that there were very few third trimester abortions, and in terms of the larger picture of abortion, very few actually do take place in the third trimester. But there are many in the second trimester, and this particular essay points to the fact that what's happening in terms of the majority of abortions that take place between the third and 6 months of pregnancy In that middle trimester, as it's described, the standard practice is indeed the tearing apart of the child. I must admit to you that at this point, I'm having an excruciating difficulty knowing how to discuss this, but I simply can't live with my conscience if I don't discuss it. Even among those who are pro-life, one of the difficulties is actually coming to terms with what an abortion is to remind ourselves of why this particular issue is unavoidable. Why our engagement with this issue as believing Christians isn't just something that is an elective application of worldview thinking, but rather is an urgent moral cause that should summon our attention and everything within us. But the clash of worldviews that is evident here is one we simply have to heed. We simply have to understand it. Because in this essay, there is a doctor cited, that is Dr. David Grimes, a clinical professor at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He is also an abortion provider. He told the website, quote, "The language is so vague," speaking of the legislation. And by the way, it's not vague. It's overly specific. So specific, I can't read it on this program, even as it is a piece of legislation actually now proposed in the state of South Dakota. I can't read it to you. This doctor says the language is so vague that this would be impossible to enforce. And then he says it reveals a lack of knowledge of the procedures that the bill proposes to outlaw, end quote. But as this essay makes clear, the problem really isn't a lack of awareness of what's going on in these procedures, but an all too unavoidable awareness. And in terms of how this has become standard procedure, Culp Ressler writes, quote, "This is the method of second trimester abortion that researchers from the World Health Organization endorse, and is now preferred by the vast majority of U.S. patients having mid-trimester terminations because," she says, "it's a simple outpatient procedure with a low risk of complications," end quote. Except, of course, for the unborn child who is destroyed. One dimension of the importance of this essay is how the actuality of what's going on here isn't really denied. It's just dismissed as being in any way morally meaningful. In one of the most chilling sentences in this essay, the author writes about the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, writing, quote, "The conversation shifted away from women who need abortion care and toward unborn babies." The words "unborn babies" are put in quotation marks, as if there actually is no such thing. As if this is simply some kind of invented category. And then she continues, toward unborn babies being brutally ripped from the womb. She then says that due to that kind of framing, and by that she means that kind of rhetorical argument, eventually the bans on partial birth abortion were passed not only by several states, but eventually by Congress. At some point, we have to acknowledge that here we are facing not only the culture of death, and not only an argument that is insidiously evil, but we're also looking at an argument that simply won't work. Because when you're thinking about an unborn child, when you're thinking about that unborn baby, there is no doubt that the woman, in general terms, who is carrying a child refers to that child as a baby. And remember that we're talking here about a child that might be moments from being otherwise a healthy born child. But we've now reached the point that we have arguments being made in public in which you have very recognized academic and cultural leaders who are describing that unborn baby as if it's just a term of art, as if it's somehow just propaganda to refer to the unborn child as an unborn baby. So far as these pro-abortion advocates are concerned, there is no baby until they say there is a baby. And at that point, it's going to be in a bassinet or a cradle, nowhere in the womb. We must always pay careful moral attention to language. And here, the positive language is reserved for, quote, "abortion care," end quote. But of course, we're not talking about anything that would normally be described as care. We're talking about a procedure to eliminate, to terminate the life within. A lot of these arguments have been around for a long time, but it is very interesting that now that these new forms of legislation are being proposed in several states, there is an aggressiveness coming from the pro-abortion argument side in which they are now making arguments that seemingly defy moral imagination. And what's truly frightening about what's revealed in this essay is that the writer seems to have no moral hesitation whatsoever in making these arguments, nor do any of the authorities cited in her essay. This makes perfect sense to them according to their worldview. It makes perfect sense to put the words "unborn baby" in quotation marks. It makes sense to talk about the termination of life simply as abortion care. When we're dealing with the abortion issue, whether it's in the form of some kind of moral debate or a personal conversation, or when we're looking at the political debate unfolding, we need to recognize what is at stake. Nothing less than the dignity and sanctity of every single human life at every point of development. What's at stake is the Imago Dei, that is the very clear biblical affirmation that every single human being, in every condition, at every point of development, is fully made in the image of God. When David speaks of himself in the Psalms in terms of the Lord knitting him together in his mother's womb and knowing him before anyone else knew that he existed, he did not put himself in quotation marks. He knew himself to be a person. He knew himself to have been made in the image of God. He knew himself to matter. And in terms of politics, this matters more than most other issues that gain the headlines. Just a few days ago, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, would not directly answer the question asked her as to whether or not a child at 20 weeks of pregnancy is a human being. Her response, quote, "You know what? What we're talking about on the floor of the House is something that says politicians should determine what affects the health of a woman, her life, her health, and the rest. I don't think it's up to politicians to do that." And that's why, she said, "we are very overwhelmingly opposing what is going on the floor of the House," end quote. Echoing the logic found in that Think Progress essay, Representative Pelosi said, quote, "You know, it is really interesting that you would come to these meetings to talk about it," end quote, the it being the unborn child. She went on to say, quote, "The fact is what we have said. The life and the health of the mother is what is preeminent in when a decision is made about a woman's reproductive health. It isn't an ideological fight," she said. "It is a personal health issue," end quote. That's the kind of moral dodge that we're now growing more and more accustomed to in terms of politicians. But we need to track that back to the worldview that stands behind it. We need to understand that, as is the case in so many other issues, when it comes to the sanctity and dignity of human life, there really isn't an array of positions. There really isn't a middle position or a third way. What we're really looking at here is that either that unborn child is a human being made in the image of God, or it is simply tissue that doesn't matter. There really is no secular argument that seems to have any traction in pointing to the importance of that unborn child unless that unborn child is made in the image of God. Once everything is reduced simply to the moral agency of the mother and the baby disappears, inevitably you end up with the kind of argument that appeared at Think Progress. And this gets right to the heart of the Christian conscience. We must know, we must always know, that the elimination of the baby, the eclipse of the baby from the equation, is the one thing that must never happen, ever. The moment he or she becomes unimportant to the conversation, then so eventually will the disabled, so eventually will the aged, so will anyone who doesn't meet our expectation of what it means to be a human person if we get to set that expectation in terms of our own calculation by means of some secular worldview. I'll admit, in the history of doing the briefing, this is the most difficult essay to discuss. I would like to have found some way to have avoided it. I couldn't. This is the challenge we now face, and face it we must. Next, talking about children, I want to talk about a story that appeared in several national and international news sources in recent days. It has to do, as the Wall Street Journal reports, with the fact that French police questioned a French citizen after that individual allegedly made comments in support of terrorists, part, says the paper, of a controversial crackdown on extremist propaganda in the wake of the deadly attacks in the French capital in recent weeks. You might wonder why the interrogation of one individual in France would lead to this kind of headline-grabbing attention. The next paragraph from the Wall Street Journal article will make it clear. Quote, "Police in the French city of Nice said Thursday they had questioned a boy and his father to determine how the boy picked up what they described as alarming statements in support of the gunman who killed 12 people in a terrorist attack on the magazine Charlie Hebdo," end quote. We're talking about the interrogation of an 8-year-old boy. According to Sam Schlichter and N.T. Landaro, writing for the Wall Street Journal, quote, "I'm with the terrorist," the boy, identified only as Ahmed, said in class discussions, that according to a lawyer for the family. He says the boy didn't understand the meaning of the word terrorist and described the decision to refer him to police as total insanity. However, most frighteningly, as the article unfolds, it appears that the police had a very legitimate concern. The Journal reports the investigation into the circumstances surrounding the boy's remarks, which police say is continuing, underscores, they say, the challenge France faces in balancing free speech with combating terrorism. They go on to say that the French schools have been particular battlegrounds. Quote, "After the attacks this month, France's education ministry directed teachers to report any behavior challenging the values of the Republic to school officials. You'll recall recently on the briefing we discussed the fact that the French government was spending a lot of money, supposedly to train teachers in how to train students in secularism." The reason I raise this article is because it demonstrates a couple of things of fundamental importance to us. The first thing is quite obvious. What a child hears at home, eventually the child says on his own. The press coverage on this particular issue has made that clear. As the Journal reports, when Ahmed's father was summoned to the school to discuss his son's behavior, education ministry's officials said that the father responded with violent threats, leading the school to alert police. While the French are giving attention to how the elementary schools in that country frame the worldview of students, seeking to ground those students in the worldview of secularism, the fact is that the worldview of the home is far more formative in the life of a child than the worldview of the school. And even as the French may be trying to invest a great deal of money in training teachers to inculcate secularism in these students, the reality is that the family is going to overcome what takes place in the schools. And once again, we have to note that secularism as a worldview is just rather defenseless and weak over against any form of theism, in particular, the kind of theism that is represented by the Muslim beliefs of this French family. While France has been doing its very best by national determination over the course of the last 200 plus years to eradicate the public influence of Christianity, the vacuum that was left behind hasn't been filled by the secularism the French had hoped. Rather, increasingly, neighborhood by neighborhood, headline by headline, what we're seeing is that Islam is now overtaking secularism in terms of potency and in terms of the battle for the young, especially when it comes to the young as represented by this 8-year-old boy who came to the attention of French authorities. According to the coverage of the same account in the New York Times, the boy said to his school teacher, quote, "We must kill the French. I am with the terrorists. Muslims have done well. The journalists deserve to die," end quote. One other aspect of the story is to understand that this 8-year-old boy didn't come with a very unformed argument. He came with a very specific, well-formed argument. He seemed to know exactly what he was asserting. He seemed to know exactly what he was saying. That makes the story all the more concerning. You put all this together and you realize that we are continually involved in a battle for the minds of every single individual and dare not leave out the youngest among us. Here we're talking about an 8-year-old boy and the fact that French authorities now know they must take him, his statements, his worldview, and his threats seriously. They simply have to. And though it's not acknowledged in the article, it does seem that there is some resignation to the fact that they can't overcome this kind of argument with nothing but secularism. Finally, another article that appeared recently in the Wall Street Journal just points to what it means to live in such a dangerous age and to live in such a dangerous time. The article by Damian Paletta is entitled CIA Taps Undercover Spider as Its Top Spy. This article seems like something that would have come out of a James Bond movie, or something written as an historical, fictional thriller. But as Damian Paletta reports, the Central Intelligence Agency has selected a new top spy, tapping an undercover veteran who played a central role in developing personal relationships with Afghan leaders after the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. Now, what makes this article really interesting is how this top spy for America is now identified, simply by one name, Spider. As the journal reports, he remains undercover and is known within the agency as Spider. His new role will be director of the National Clandestine Service, a position that effectively makes him responsible for all the CIA's spying activities. According to the journal, the CIA wouldn't reveal any information about the new NCS chief. A spokesman said the agency had elevated, quote, one of the CIA's most gifted and versatile leaders. According to the article, Spider is succeeding another agency veteran whom the agency also wouldn't identify. He's likely to be based at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. An article like this can quickly pass by without our understanding what's really being revealed here. We're living in a world in which it seems to make sense that we would have an individual assigned this kind of responsibility that is reported in the international media, so long as the agent is described only by one name, Spider. We're living in a world in which a government like the United States can't operate in the blind. It has to have some means of gaining information. And we're living in an age in which that information can make the difference between life and death, and very quickly. We're living in a world in which the preservation of liberties requires individuals assigned by our government to do things that no one else would be either assigned to do or allowed to do. We're looking at the fact that in a fallen world, very dark things happen. So dark that here we have an announcement made in nothing less than the Wall Street Journal about the appointment of America's new top spy, identified as the one who will be head of the National Clandestine Service. And that clandestine part is really important because all we know about this person who is now the top spy for the United States is that his name is Spider. You didn't watch that in a fictional television series. You didn't just read that in terms of a fictional narrative. This is the Wall Street Journal. This is real life. And of course, in a fallen world like this, one other thing is very clear. Out there, you can be sure, are other spiders. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember, the upcoming new release of Ask Anything Weekend Edition, the new series, begins on Saturday, February the 14th. Call with your question in your voice to 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.